MacCast, Friday, February 22nd, 2013. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. This is the first MacCast after our Macworld show. I got a lot of feedback from you. I'm glad that many of you enjoyed those episodes and those interviews. I try and do as many of those things as possible at Macworld, but it is a crazy time. As I've mentioned before, if you've ever had an inkling for going out to Macworld, it is a really fun event. And with what IDG and Paul Kent and the Macworld folks are doing, Macworld iWorld folks are doing, is really transforming the show into having a real community focus. So I think it falls more and more every year in line with the spirit of the MacCast. And so if you've ever considered coming out, think about it for next year. It is a whole lot of fun. And as you can tell from the interviews and the stuff I put out on the feed, it's a good time for everyone. It's a good time to hang out and catch up, learn things about your Mac and iOS devices, and just have a general good time. So hopefully we'll see you out there next year. But we got a lot of great stuff to get into in this episode. Lots of stuff to talk about, and we probably should not delay in diving into all of that. So let me take a quick moment to thank one of our show sponsors, Smile. I want to talk to you a little bit about Text Expander. This is an application I literally couldn't do the MacCast without. It gives you the ability to set up little snippets, little short codes that get expanded into longer blocks of text. And why would you want to do that? Well, you'd want to do that to save time when you need to reply to emails. And it's great if you have to do customer support, if you have to answer a lot of questions like me, but it's also great just for general day-to-day use. You can do things like correct typos. Do you ever have those words that you type in and you always seem to misspell them the wrong way? You know that you do it. I do this with download all the time. I swap the O and the A. And it's not because I don't know how to spell it. It's just how I type. Something about the cadence or the way I type things out, I swap those two characters. So I just put in a little text expander snippet with it spelt the way I type it and have it correct to the right one. So it'll auto-correct those sorts of typos. And you can do that for all sorts of things. You can download, they have a snippet set that is accented words. So if you don't want to have to remember to hit the option E and then the E again to do an accented E, you can set up snippets for all the accented words you might use, or just download the ones that Text Expander gives you. And one of the coolest new features or expanded features in Text Expander 4 is fill-in forms. So you can actually create little fill-in areas that when you expand, when you type your short code and it does the expansion, right at expansion time, you can add additional information. So this is great for anything where you might need to put in a little bit of dynamic information. So where most of the thing that you want to expand is standard, but you need to fill in a couple areas, say a name or a phone number or some sort of bit of variable data, you can put in a field that you can add that text right at expansion time. And they now have features to do multiple choice pop-ups. They have optional fields, so you can create whole optional sections that you can either turn on or off. It's really, really powerful. And I just started using this feature more and more, and I absolutely love it. So you can do all those sorts of things. You can put in common things like email addresses, alternate email addresses, phone numbers, just about anything you can think of, it can adapt to. And it's really, really powerful. So if you haven't checked it out, you really should. Plus, you can sync all that stuff to your iOS devices too. And the way they've done that is they created an API. So Text Expander Touch on iOS is integrated with over 140 of your favorite applications, apps like Day One, AI Writer, Byword, which is one of my favorites, OmniFocus Things. They have a huge list on their website. You can check it out. So check out Text Expander and all the amazing products that Smile makes over at smilesoftware.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Apple updated the 15-inch MacBook Pro line to a Retina display back in June of 2012, and then followed that up with a Retina update to the 13-inch models just back last October. But that did not stop them this week from issuing an update to both those models. Well, actually, a price drop on the 13-inch models and an update to the 15-inch models. They did it kind of quietly just through a press release on their website and updated models showing up online. They basically dropped the prices of the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro models, $200 to $300. The 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro starts now at $1,499 for the 128GB flash storage model, and then the 2.6GHz processor version with 256MB of flash or gigabytes of flash storage is now priced at $1,699. Along with the price reductions on the 13 inches, Apple updated the 15-inch model with Retina display to have a faster processor. It now features a 2.4GHz quad-core processor on the base model, and that is something that you can upgrade to a 2.7GHz quad-core processor with up to 16GB of RAM. As far as what that means for performance, recent Geekbench numbers this week showed about a 3 to 5% gain in performance on those updated models. Coincidentally, Apple also dropped the price of the 13-inch MacBook Air with 256GB of flash storage. They dropped it $100, bringing its base price now down to $1,399 US. And I don't know if this is related or not, but there is a rumor coming out of the Taiwan Economic Times. They're reporting that Apple is planning to update the 13-inch MacBook Air. They're saying sometime in the third quarter, and that Apple is currently working to line up suppliers to make that new model. They say that the big update will be a move from Intel's current mobile processors to the new Haswell platform, and there will be a possible update to a Retina display in the MacBook Air. Now, KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo also reported that his sources are saying that Apple will update the MacBook Air models sometime late in the second quarter, possibly early in the third quarter, so that backs up the report from Taiwan Economic Times. But where he differs is that he says that it will not feature a Retina screen, mostly due to the battery requirements and the requirement to have a thicker display assembly, something that I guess he believes Apple doesn't want to do. They want to keep the Air nice and thin, which that's the whole point behind the moniker, right? So would make sense. A Retina screen certainly would add significantly also to the component cost for Apple. Apple could potentially, I would guess, introduce a Retina MacBook Air like they did with the Pro line, so have the standard Air and then a premium-priced version with the Retina screen. They could sell both for a little while. I guess we won't have too long to find out if these rumors turn out to be true, because, again, they're both predicting we'll see these models hit sometime in the third quarter. With Apple's stock price sliding and now taking sort of this day-to-day up-and-down roller coaster ride, many analysts and Wall Street folks are now expressing the opinion that it's time for Tim Cook to step up and prove himself and finally bring out the next big thing from Apple. I can say I personally don't share those sentiments at all. As a matter of fact, when I started reading these reports and hearing people saying Apple needs to do something, that they're in danger of losing their edge or losing their innovation, I went back and I sort of historically looked at what I consider to be Apple's major hardware inventions over the past years, starting with the Apple I and II, and then looking at the Macintosh, the PowerPC, the Intel transition, maybe even the Newton. I kind of questioned that one a little bit, but then the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad, and looked at how far is it between each one of those innovations, and it seemed to work out between 3 to 7 years, depending on which year and which hardware devices you were looking at. And more recently, that's been stepped up a little bit. So about every 3 to 4 years, Apple seems to be bringing out a new innovative product. So since the iPad was just announced in 2010, it's now, we're just starting 2013. I would say that Apple, if they do something big either this year or next year, they're actually maintaining their current pace of innovation. So I don't really get where that's coming from. But even Steve Wozniak expressed concerns this week in an interview, I think with a German publication, that Apple could be in danger of losing its sort of cool factor or its coolness, and it's sliding a little bit. Now, he's historically over the past few years been moving more and more and been more and more impressed by what's happening with Android. And I think that's right. Android and Google are doing some amazing things. There's a lot of people innovating, taking and sort of building upon what Apple did with the iPhone and the iPad and stuff like that. But I hardly think that we're in a situation where Apple is losing their edge. I still see a lot of those products mimicking and copying stuff that Apple's been doing, sort of iterating on those ideas. Every once in a while, there's a spark of innovation and something that maybe Apple riffs off of as well. So there is a back and forth to this, but sort of these major breakthrough announcements, I haven't seen anybody else other than Apple really doing that in any significant way over the past few years. So I think Apple still has an opportunity. And as a matter of fact, at a Goldman conference this week, Tim Cook denied these claims. He said that the innovation culture at Apple has, quote, never been stronger. So what is Apple going to do? There's been speculation over an Apple-branded television. Their latest rumors are focused around a smartwatch or a connected watch. Could it be both? Are they the same thing? There was an interesting report by one writer this week who postulated that the iWatch could actually refer to an Apple television. And when I first read that, I thought, well, that's kind of crazy. But then when you think about it, iWatch, you know, as in iWatch TV, that could make sense from that regard. But I don't think that's what's going on. Most of the rumors seem to be pointed at that Apple has been sort of playing in both these arenas. They're looking at the television market and have been for years. And it sounds like now that they are also looking at a connected devices market, that they've been exploring a lot of different sort of connected devices, and a watch would be a logical one to move forward with. We know that with the Square Nano, a lot of people used those as watches, and Apple played around with things like watch faces in the iPod interface so that you could actually use that device as a watch, even though it wasn't initially designed for that. And so this past week, we really saw these rumors of an Apple-branded smartwatch get sort of stronger and stronger. There were a couple of reliable sources this past week that started leaking the same rumors. And when we start hearing the same sort of rumors from these sources, one tends to think either there's some legitimacy behind them or that Apple is sort of running their PR machine behind the scenes and leaking out these rumors to select members of the media to kind of keep a buzz going as they develop these products and get closer and closer to an announcement. So what happened is Bloomberg this week reported that Apple has over 100 designers actually working on a smartwatch product, and that they continue to grow that team. Most of the reports, as far as what the device is going to look like, state that it's going to have some sort of curved glass face, likely using the Corning bendable willow glass technology that was recently announced and I think talked about following CES. The belief is that it will be a device with a 2.5-inch display, possibly OLED, although Apple has never really been that into OLED displays, but for a watch-type application, it would make a lot of sense. The displays are bright. They would look good outdoors. They also are energy efficient, so you'll be able to maximize your battery life and what have you. There's also been some rumors that for the casing, Apple may finally take advantage of the deal they have, the exclusive deal that they have with Liquid Metal, the Liquid Metal technology, that it may be incorporated into the strap or maybe even into the casing itself. This one I have a little bit of trouble believing, because last year, a representative from Liquid Metal said that the manufacturing technology to make high volume parts and do high volume productions on a consumer level product was actually still years away. So unless Apple somehow accelerated that technology, I don't see that happening. I guess it could end up in a strap or in some of the component parts, and maybe that's where some of those rumors are coming from. As far as what the operating system might look like, it's assumed it'll be running iOS. Maybe, I would guess, a variation of it. I don't know if it'll run the same iOS that we would see on the iPhone. And iPods, you know, for example, the iPod Nano, which has a much smaller screen, actually has a customized OS. It's an iPod OS. It's not iOS. So even though it looks like it in a lot of ways, it would have to sort of be redesigned for that smaller 2.5-inch screen. It's expected that it will have some sort of wireless connectivity, probably low power Bluetooth, and that it would connect directly with your iPhone, your iPod Touch, and be sort of a conduit, not necessarily have cellular technology built in, although I would imagine in future products that could show up. I'd be surprised if we saw a cellular-connected iWatch right out of the gate. I just think that the technology in terms of the mobile chipsets just isn't there in terms of power and size and performance and that sort of thing. And I think most of the rumors are saying that it is going to be simply a connected device that will work in conjunction with, say, your iPhone. So as far as some of the functionality that's being rumored out there, you would be able to get things like notifications and updates on the screen, so you can have weather and time and stock quotes, and I would imagine things like sports scores and all kinds of things pushed to it. It supposedly will have a built-in microphone, so you would be able to use it to take calls, and I would imagine also control things like Siri. You would be able to have your music player controls on there to be able to control different functions on your iOS devices without having to take them out of your pocket. And so in almost every way, it's very much a companion device to your existing iOS devices. As for what the design is going to be, there's only a lot of speculation at this point. There have been a lot of people sort of taking a stab at what Apple might do in terms of the look of a smartwatch. So there's some really cool 3D renderings floating around the various Mac news sites. But one thing that happened late this week is there was an interesting patent that surfaced from Apple for something that a lot of people are calling like a slap watch. It sort of looks like a slap bracelet, if anybody remembers those from back in the 80s. In essence, a flat band that would flex around your wrist to become an interactive display watch style device. It would connect wirelessly with your phone and offer things like iTunes control, according to the patent, and it would give you access to things like maps and on-screen keyboard controls for messages. And one of the most interesting parts of the patent is that the display would actually resize dynamically to match the wrist of the person wearing it, so that you wouldn't have the kind of situation where if you had a smaller wrist, the screen would actually wrap over the edge and you'd kind of have to rotate your wrist awkwardly to get at all of the information. So it would be smart and adapt that way. Now, while this patent is really cool and does seem to point to Apple looking at different watch designs, it's important to remember that patents are simply that. They're awarded and issued. Companies apply for them to, in many cases, protect an idea, make sure that somebody doesn't necessarily take it. And certainly it doesn't mean that all the patents that are ever issued to a company end up as actual products in development. I think most of us know that, but it was just the timing of this one was very interesting because it was just awarded this week amidst all of this rumor and speculation that Apple is actually working on a watch. Now, while Apple is typically an innovator and somebody that most other companies follow, Apple this week followed suit in the ranks of Facebook and Twitter as being the third company to announce that their employees' computers had been compromised and hacked by a recent Java exploit. The attack is being referred to by security experts as a watering hole style attack, and that's because All Things D, who sort of broke the story, believed that the source of the hack was a popular iOS development forum site that was likely visited by members of the Apple, Facebook, and Twitter development teams, and that's where the exploit was launched and their systems were compromised. So rather than targeting individuals, say like a phishing attack where attackers try to send an email with an attachment or something where it's going to inject code from a local system, in this case, the attack was perpetrated and launched against the destination where many of those users would go, in essence, poisoning the waterhole. After Apple had acknowledged that the small number of their corporate systems had been compromised by the hack, they quickly released Java for OS 10 2013-001 update. This update patched Java SE 6 to Java version 1.6.041. It also would go in and disable Java SE 6, the applet plugin, on systems that had not already installed the prior Java update from Apple, which was OS 10 update 2012-006. You can get the Java update via the Apple Store or the App Store update system. So if you just launch your Mac App Store on your system, or if you go through Software Update and System Preferences, or you can also download it directly from Apple's support website at apple.com/support. Really, the best way to protect yourself, though, is to disable Java in your browser. Most often, these attacks are launched through the browser plugin. So if you don't need Java running in your browser, it's best if you disable it. If you use Safari, you can just go into the security section of the preferences and uncheck the Java option. Java isn't installed by default on Lion or Mountain Lion anymore. If you do need to install it, it will prompt you. It'll ask you to install. If you don't need to install it, you probably don't want to. When you do need it, you can get it later, and that's going to be the best way to keep yourself protected. As far as the full extent of Apple's exposure as a result of the exploit, it looks like it turned out to be not as bad as it could have been. Of course, it's very serious that we have companies like Facebook and Twitter and Apple getting their systems compromised, but Apple released an official statement that said, per their initial investigation, it looks like that the exposed systems did not have any of their data actually leave Apple. So from that side of things, it looks like at least this time Apple got lucky. For the past few weeks, we've been hearing rumors and speculation that Apple's iPhone sales were starting to slow down and potentially even sag. Many had been saying that Apple's iPhone 5 was going to see lower than expected sales going into the end of the year last year. And as a matter of fact, the rumors were so loud and so frequent that that was one of the reasons that Apple's stock started to slide. But now it looks like those fears were exactly just that. Fears. A new report from Strategy Analytics this past week showed that the iPhone 5 handily beat out the uber-popular Samsung Galaxy S3 to become the world's best-selling smartphone for the fourth quarter. Strategy Analytics estimates that Apple shipped 27.4 million units worldwide during the fourth quarter of 2012, earning a 13% share of the worldwide smartphone shipments. Not only that, the iPhone 4S is estimated to have also shipped an additional 17.4 million units. That's about 8% of total global smartphone shipments for the same quarter. The Galaxy S3 handsets, on the other hand, slid 18% from the third quarter, with Samsung shipping an estimated of 15.4 million units in the quarter. That's 2 million less than the iPhone 4S and almost half as many units as the iPhone 5. So I'm thinking it will be amazing to see how many iPhones Apple ships when they aren't in a slump. So unit numbers and unit shipment numbers are a big deal, but one thing that Apple knows better than most other companies is that more often than not, it's not how many you sell that matters, but how much you make off of what you sell. A new report by NPD shows that percentage-wise, Apple raked in more than double the amount of 2012 U.S. consumer technology revenue than their nearest competitor, which happened to be Samsung. As a matter of fact, Apple and Samsung were only two of the top five technology companies to actually increase their revenue share over last year's numbers. Apple's share increased by 2.6%, allowing them to grab a 19.9%, almost 20% share of the U.S. consumer technology revenue market. Samsung also increased their share by 2.3%, grabbing 9.3% of the share. Despite Apple and Samsung increasing their combined sales revenue by $6.5 billion, the industry as a whole saw a 2% decline for the year, declining roughly $9.5 billion. Apple also ranked as the third top U.S. consumer technology retailer for 2012, coming in after Best Buy and Walmart, but ahead of Amazon and Staples. Interestingly, Staples recently announced that they are now an official Apple retailer. There's a couple of software updates that were released this week that I want to let you know about. iTunes 11.0.2 was released. It adds a new composer view for music, also improved the responsiveness when handling large playlists, fixes a bug for purchases that were not showing up in iTunes, and also has additional stability and performance updates. The composer view is not enabled by default and can be a little bit tricky to find. So if you want to turn it on, you need to go into the iTunes menu preferences under general, and then under the views, make sure you check on the show composers option. That's a new option that you'll see in there. Once you've enabled it, the new tab will appear between artists and genres when you're in the music library view, and then you can view all of your music by composer. Apple also released another update for iOS 6. iOS 6.1.2 specifically addresses a bug that affected users who connected their devices to Exchange servers for email. The bug caused an out-of-control polling of calendars and mailboxes on the Exchange server. The result was excessive network load on the Exchange network and also excessive battery drain on the iOS device. So not good for IT administrators, not good for iPhone owners. As a matter of fact, it got so bad that Microsoft actually recommended in extreme cases that IT managers block iOS 6.1 or 6.1.1 users from the Exchange server altogether. Apple, of course, had a less extreme workaround that involved accessing the Exchange mail settings on your iOS device and turning calendars off and then back on again. Both Microsoft and Apple worked together to address the issue and thus the release of the patch this week. Last week, Apple also issued iOS update 6.1.1 specifically for the iPhone 4S that addressed an issue that could impact cellular performance and reliability. The iOS 6.1.2 update, though, did not fix a recent security hole that was discovered in iOS 6.1 that could allow users with physical access to your device to bypass the lock screen. Now, there's a giant rigmarole you have to go through to actually execute this hack. It's kind of crazy. I'm going to give it to you. You're probably not going to be able to replicate it, and you might actually end up accidentally calling 911 in the process, so I don't advise you try. But in essence, the way it works is you go into the emergency call screen, you begin the power off sequence, but then cancel it. Then you need to try and make an emergency call and quickly cancel that. Then you put the phone into standby mode, you wake it back up, do the swipe to unlock, and then finally tap the emergency call button again after holding down the power button for 3 to 4 seconds and hit the home button right away to prevent the phone from shutting off. So again, good luck doing that. But once you've done that, it would give you full control over the entire phone app as well as the contacts, and you can access the device's camera roll. It will not give you access to email, messaging, or browsing, however. Apple did promise a fix for the exploit, but we now know that it wasn't part of the 6.1.2 update. As a matter of fact, just on Thursday, Apple released iOS 6.1.3 beta to developers, which does patch the flaw, so I expect that we'll see another quick update to iOS 6 sometime soon. If you want to grab the most recent iOS 6.1.2 update or the 6.1.1 update, you can do that through iTunes or directly on your device using the iOS update feature. I think we've heard rumors of a Retina iPad mini update coming almost from the day the original iPad mini was released. Well, this week, a Chinese site, WePhone, claimed to have images of a rear casing of an iPad mini with a Retina screen. I have to say it looks pretty much just like the current back case of a white iPad mini, except maybe slightly thicker. Assumptions online are that it is thicker because the Retina update, like the Retina update to the iPad 3, would require Apple to make a slightly thicker case to accommodate a larger battery. That way they can drive all those extra pixels and not lose any of the battery life on the device. The images also show the Apple logo and the iPad mini logo type on the back in blue. Looking at the picture, to me, it looks very reminiscent of the blue Apple logo that was on the PowerMac G3 Tower. So if you remember that. Some sites are speculating that it may be Apple's way of introducing color into the iPad mini line. My guess, though, is that assuming the images are even real, it's some sort of protective film, maybe meant to cover the polished surfaces in those areas during manufacturing, or it could be some sort of coating that's later removed during a finishing process to actually do the polishing in those regions. I'm not really sure, but it didn't look to me like it was the kind of thing where Apple would put those out as the colors. I would imagine if they were going to do colors, they'd do more like they did with the iPod Touch with a different colored anodized backs. There are estimates, though, that putting a Retina display in the iPad mini could increase Apple's total part costs up to about 30%. That might be a little bit tricky for Apple, especially since they already make a lower margin on the mini versus, say, the 9.7-inch iPad. Typically, Apple doesn't like to increase pricing when they release new updated models, so you'd have to figure out how they're going to make their margins on a system that's going to cost them 30% more to produce. My guess is that they could spin it off as a new upper level option, again, offering non-Retina versions and Retina versions, maybe at a $75 to $100 a price increase over the existing non-Retina versions, and then possibly keeping or lowering the pricing on the non-Retina models to kind of fill out the line. But we're going to have to wait and see. I think regardless, it makes a lot of sense for Apple to move to a Retina version of the Mini for the next update, because that's its probably biggest complaint that you hear from most people. So it would definitely be the logical next step for Apple to take. The questions are still swirling, obviously, though, whether or not they can do it and maintain the technology in terms of the thinness of the design, the battery life, and of course, covering the additional component costs. And as far as when the update might happen, your guess is as good as mine, but if there are already pictures surfacing of this rear casing, I would imagine it's going to happen sooner than later. And then finally, the news for this week. If you're in Europe and you want a Mac Pro, you better grab one quick. It started to disappear early in Europe. You may remember back in January, Apple announced that they would officially stop selling the Mac Pro in Europe due to regulations on the power supply that's used in that model. Now, it looks like Apple may be running out of stock before the deadline, and they likely have no plans to stock back up before March, which I think is when the official deadline hits, March 1st. The unofficial Apple web blog recently noticed that virtually all the EU Apple online stores are showing the units as currently unavailable. And so if you're in the EU and you want one, you probably want to start checking your local Apple store or your local Apple authorized reseller pretty quick. That's if you want the existing model. Now, there still really is hope that the something for our Mac Pro customers product that Tim Cook promised late last year would start showing up sometime in the near future to help fill the void that's going to be left by the Mac Pro. Actually, that void has been growing, I guess, for over the past 3 years. It's been about 3 years since Apple updated the Pro line, and I think Pro customers are getting pretty having their patience tested, I guess, is the best way we could put it. And Apple's going to need to step up and do something soon. It was assumed Apple would do something in the first quarter of this year, and we haven't really seen that happen yet. So I don't know if sort of Apple letting this run out and not replacing the Pro models with something that meets the regulations in Europe is a sign that Apple's getting ready to finally release that update, or if it's a sign that the Mac Pro is on the way out. But certainly if you want the existing line, they're getting scarce in Europe, so grab it now. And with that, that'll do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. Look, if you need to build a website and you want to do it without any hassle, you really need to check out Squarespace. They have a beautiful and very intuitive website platform that really allows anyone to easily create a professional web page, blog, gallery, all on a single platform. And they just launched built-in e-commerce, so now you can also sell digital and physical items from your website all within the Squarespace platform. And it's going to look great too, because with Squarespace, you start from amazing templates that are built by their award-winning design team. They also have user experience experts, so you know it's going to work and flow well. And all you really need to do to get started is just sign up. So you go there, you sign up, and you will immediately have access to their entire system. You pick your template, and then you just start loading in your content. You add your images, your text, your products, connect up your social media accounts. They have widgets and things that make that really simple and easy. And you end up with an amazing looking site. And not only that, their templates are designed to scale. So they're going to look great on iPhones, on Android devices, on tablets, all the way up to your laptops and your desktops. And building the site is just really the beginning of the service, because Squarespace also gives you all of your hosting, your cloud hosting, your real-time analytics. They have an award-winning 24/7 support team, so you have backup. If you get in trouble, you can contact them. And plus, if you sign up for a year, you'll even get a free domain name, so you don't even have to worry about that. It's all in one place. For your free trial, all you have to do is go to squarespace.com/maccastnow. There's no credit card required. You can just jump in, start playing with the system, start building your site, working on it, and when you decide to purchase it, you use the offer code MACCAST2 and you'll get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. And that includes both monthly and annual plans. So that's squarespace.com/MACCAST and use the offer code MACCAST2 and you'll have everything you need to create an exceptional website. And a big thank you to Squarespace for their support of the MACCAST. A few episodes back now, I mentioned that I was looking through the console logs, researching something for one of the segments I was doing, and I noticed seeing a whole series of items related to Safari and Flash for something called, well, I called it at the time Noop, but when I searched for it, I discovered it probably didn't stand for Noop or wasn't pronounced Noop. It's actually a term called NoOp, which is short for No Operation. And I thought I mentioned during the show that I did know that Noop wasn't Noop, it was NoOp. And a couple people, though, called me out afterwards explaining the whole situation and explaining what NoOp was. And I just thought it was kind of fun to say Noop. I mean, really, what's funner to say, Noop or NoOp? But regardless, it does stand for No Operation. I wanted to clarify that in this episode. And basically, it's a command or instruction that's designed not to do anything. Johan explained in an email to me that a program could execute something when scheduled to do so, but on the CPU, not actually do anything at all. And so no operation commands have been around for a long time. And I guess sometimes it's used to help do things like keep an idle connection open. So in an FTP application, it might use no op or no operations to kind of tickle and keep the connection going. And that's likely what it's doing in the case of Safari or Flash. Johan also mentioned that he did some digging on the WebKit dev forums and found that it's quite common for WebKit to actually warn about when a JavaScript just-in-time compiler thinks that a JavaScript function isn't doing anything, that it'll actually throw out one of these no-op warnings and optimize it out. So what I might be seeing may have something to do with WebKit and debugging in the Safari JavaScript just-in-time compiler. And I could be seeing that in my instance because I do enable and turn on the developer menu. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in this episode. But just wanted to clarify Noop, or what is really no op or no operation. And those of you who are programming geeks out there definitely know what no op is. Another thing we had talked about a couple shows back was a question that we actually got from Brad, and he had asked if there was some sort of way to specifically see which files Time Machine was backing up as it was running. And I offered some ways to search through the log files for the backup daemon entries, the backup D entries that were in the console log. And while there's some information there, there wasn't a whole lot of detail, not down to the specific sort of file level. So I had asked you if you knew of some tools and utilities where we could dig in and maybe get a little more information about what was going on with Time Machine to share that information with us. And Luis wrote in and told me about a command line utility that's actually pretty powerful. TMUtil, I'm assuming it stands for Time Machine Utility, but TMUtil is a powerful command line command that can do lots of stuff. So be careful with it. You can check the man pages if you know how to do that from the terminal. Just type man TMUtility to see all the different options and things that you can do with the Time Machine Utility. But for our discussion here, I just want to talk about the thing Lewis mentioned to me, which is TMUtil compare command. And so if you open up your terminal, go into Applications Utilities, launch the terminal, and then type in TMUtil space compare. And if you're doing this live, be prepared to wait. It's going to take a while for this to run, because what it's going to do is it's going to run for a while and it'll output information to the screen as it's running. And what it does is it compares the most recent Time Machine snapshot in your Time Machine backups with the current state of what is on your Mac. So it will give you a view of what Time Machine is going to do the next time it runs, down to the specific files that it's going to go ahead and back up. So it's going to be doing that comparison step that Time Machine does right before it starts running. And at the front of each item that's listed, you're going to see there's a character, and that character is going to indicate the state in relation to the current state of your system. So the state of the snapshot versus, or what it's going to put into the snapshot versus the current state of your system. So you'll see files and paths, and if you see a plus sign in front of them, it indicates that that's a new file that's going to get added to the Time Machine backup. If it has a minus in front of it, it's indicating a file that has been removed. And if you see an exclamation point, a bang symbol, it's going to indicate that the file has changed in some way or has been updated. And there's going to be a number next to that character and before the file path, and that number indicates the size of a change. So if it's a changed file, it's going to let you know how much that space that's going to take up. And when the whole thing finishes running, when it runs through the whole process, it will give you a summary of all of the total size for everything that's going to be added, the total size that for everything that will be changed, and total sizes for the things that are going to be removed. So it does give you a lot of specific detail. So that's if you just run the straight up tmutil compare command. It's going to do the current, the most recent snapshot versus your current system. If you want to compare against an older snapshot, something that's on your Time Machine drive, you can actually add the full path to that snapshot in the terminal window from the finder. Probably the easiest way to do it is after the tmutil compare command, put a space, and then just drag the file from your Time Machine into your terminal window, and that'll paste the full path in there so you can compare specific ones. And so that is probably the most detailed information that I've been able to see or have seen on what is going to happen when a Time Machine backup runs. It'll give you right down to the specific file level. Now, Phil also wrote in and emailed me to tell me about something called Time Machine Buddy. This is actually a little dashboard widget that parses and displays the information from the backup daemon. So kind of the same stuff I told you about on that episode that you can get from looking through your console logs. It'll find that information and display it right inside your dashboard inside this widget. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. And then finally, Nathan wrote in to tell me about an app called Backup Loop. And this was probably the coolest utility that anybody had written in to me about. I'm not 100% sure, but in looking at it, my guess is that in some ways it's a graphic user interface front end for that tmutil compare command, because it kind of gives you that level of detail. In essence, what it does is when you run the application, it will go through and it will make indexes of your Time Machine snapshots. That will take quite a while. So the first time you launch it, you need to let it run and make these indexes. But once that's done, it will visually let you see what your backups are, how large those backups are, and let you potentially figure out why a specific backup might be big. It gives you this sort of color-coded list where it's green, yellow, orange, and red, indicating the relative size changes of your Time Machine backup. So you can see, oh, this one was relatively small. For some reason, this next one was really large. So if you might have a green one and then you see a red one, you can click on the red one and the sort of drill down. It gives you almost a finder column style interface that you can drill down and you can see specifically which folders and which items were taking up the most relative space within that backup. And you can drill down into your different snapshots. You can also do things like get notifications. So you can set the software up to run in the background, do indexing in the background, and it'll even give you growl notifications if a snapshot goes over a specific threshold. So if you want to be notified, hey, this snapshot was particularly large, it can let you know about that stuff. And so that's called Backup Loop, and that was a pretty cool tool. So there's definitely some items out there that will help you dig in and take a look at it, what's going on in Time Machine, even if Apple doesn't really give you that information out of the box. And I want to thank everybody who wrote in to let us know about these utilities. With this news this week that Apple got hit by this Java exploit, I am getting a lot more email and questions about security and the Macintosh. And Rick emailed me. He wanted to know that in light of these recent Java exploits, am I running Java and Flash on my systems? And if so, what am I doing or what do I recommend to keep my Mac safe or your Mac safe? And I think, Rick, really what what you're asking me about is how do we mitigate or potentially reduce our risk of exposure? Because really that's what this is all about, right? It's about doing the things, either putting preventative measures in place or avoiding risky behaviors that will help us sort of protect ourselves from exploits like this. And the most common thing we talk about is probably the one that is most frequently exploited, and that is what I like to call the human hole or sort of human error, doing dumb things or insecure things or unsafe things. And that's doing stuff like opening that email attachment from someone you don't know or clicking on that curious link in Twitter notification that you get, and you don't really know who it's from, you can't really tell what the link is, but you click on it anyway, right? And then you're hit with one of these zero-day exploits and you're infected, and then you've got a problem on your hands, right? And the best thing to do is to avoid behaving in a way that is unsafe or could expose you to the risk, and we talk about that a lot. So don't click on strange links or attachments, don't download or run software from untrusted sources. But the thing is that this latest attack recognized that most people are pretty smart about that. Like, we've talked a lot about it. People aren't doing those risky behaviors as frequently anymore. And so they used that knowledge to their advantage. And what they did is sort of reverse that, right? They targeted a site that they knew people felt was safe, and they attacked that and set that up as a launching point for their exploit to go in and infect these other systems. So we need to talk a little bit more about other measures and things that you can put in place to keep yourself protected. And I actually did a MacCast member show with George Starcher on security and the Mac, and we talked about the concept of security and layers. If you want to check that out, you can sign up, become a MacCast member, and that's part of the archive. But in essence, what we talked about in that show was avoiding these risky type behaviors. That was number one. Another layer is to use tools like antivirus scanners or use something like OpenDNS as your domain name server, because they have measures in place that will block known websites that have exploits on them, so it'll protect you at the domain name resolution level, and they can identify and protect you from making some of those risky behaviors and actions. So that's another layer. Another layer would be making sure that you use good, strong passwords on all the different websites, that you use different passwords that are strong on different websites, not the same password everywhere, and also that you periodically go through all of your accounts and you change your passwords. All of these things add to your sort of layers of security. And the more layers that you put in place, the less potential risk you have, the better protected you are. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't take these measures because sometimes they come at a slight cost inconvenience, right? If you have a different password on every website, you're going to need to have some system and some secure system for remembering all those passwords. And that's where a tool like 1Password comes in. And that's, you know, something that I use to help manage that and make the inconvenience of doing what we're supposed to do in terms of keeping our passwords secure and changing them and stuff like that. It makes that process a little bit easier, but it still is more cumbersome than just picking 1Password and using that on all the websites that you log into, right? So as OSs have become more hardened and more secure in and of themselves, so Apple and Microsoft have made great strides in sort of protecting their systems. We have sandboxing. So it's getting harder and harder for attackers to go right at the operating system. They're getting more inventive and they're coming up with more creative ways to launch these attacks. And one of the things that they're relying on is software that we add on or bolt on to our operating systems that can get down at lower levels. So things like Java and Flash and Acrobat and even QuickTime. And they're using those as their attacking points, as their attack vectors. And so a layer of security that you can add would be to simply not install or run any of those extensions, especially if you don't need them. And when you encounter a site or a tool that maybe needs one of these add-ons, it does add, once again, that layer of inconvenience. It's a little less inconvenient And the thing is you're going to have to weigh what's your risk versus your benefit, right? Can I have an alternative to Flash? Can I get that video from another site or another source? So maybe it's an HTML5. You might have to go looking for that, though, right? It's going to be much easier to hit the website. It has a Flash video. Oh, I'll just download and install Flash. Well, now Flash is on your system. And if there's a security hole in Flash, that's something outside of Apple's control, then you are potentially exposed. Same thing goes with Java, right? If you are going to websites that require Java, you install Java, you have it enabled in your browser, you're now relying on Oracle to make sure that their Java is safe and it's up to date and it's patched and what have you. So you're going to expose yourself as you add these third-party add-ons. And so the general security layer would be, don't install it unless you absolutely need it. So to answer your specific question, Rick, I have had to make these choices about the technologies that I want to use and have installed on my system based on my computer usage, the things that I need to do. And each one of us has to sort of assess this for our own systems and for the sites and services and things that we use. So I usually don't need Flash. I found more and more that less sites have it installed. It's still there for ads. Occasionally you'll encounter a video. But what I've chosen to do is just simply not install Flash at all on my system. And so if you don't want Flash on your system, you can go to Adobe's website. You can get an uninstaller, run that. That will pull all the Flash, all the plugins out of your browsers and your Mac. And then what I do when I do occasionally need to access a website where I need to use Flash, there's no other way around it, I have Google's Chrome browser installed on my system, and I just switch over and I use Chrome because Chrome has the Flash plugin built into the browser, and it's sandboxed to better protect you. So as far as I understand it, with the Flash that's inside Chrome can't break out and get outside of the Chrome browser environment. So that's going to protect you at that level, or that's what I've been told, and I'm relying on that fact. So if I got that wrong, if somebody knows differently, let me know. But as far as I've understood and been told by many people, Flash is sandboxed in Chrome. So that's how I access those few sites that I need to get Flash on. And again, that's a little less convenient because Safari is my preferred browser. If I hit a site, I have to either copy the URL and put it over, but you can actually make it a little more convenient if you use the developer menu. I mentioned that I've enabled the developer menu in Safari, and within the developer menu, there is an open page with option. So if you want to enable the developer menu, all you have to do in Safari is go into Safari Preferences under Advanced. You'll see a little checkbox that says show the developer menu in the menu bar. Turn that option on, and then that will give you a develop menu in the Safari menus. And when you hit a page where you need to open it in Chrome so that you can maybe access the Flash, all you have to do is click on the developer menu. There's an open with option, and then you just choose Google Chrome, and that will launch that URL right into Google Chrome. You don't even have to copy and paste the URL. So that makes it a little less inconvenient for me. And another option you could do is use a thing like Click to Flash or Click to Plugin. What this does is it actually blocks the Flash plugin on a page from auto-loading and auto-running. You actually have to click on the little area where the Flash would be to sort of enable it. So this is good on a couple levels. One, it'll block sites that are using Flash-based banner ads, so you just don't have to see those. Another thing, though, is if you clicked on a link and you hit a site that was maybe exploited by one of these Flash exploits, the Flash wouldn't load, and you'd have to actually physically interact with it. So it provides an extra layer. But really, if you don't need Flash, don't install it at all. And also, as with any add-on or third-party thing, just make sure you always keep it up to date. When exploits do arise, companies like Adobe and Oracle have gotten pretty good about releasing patches and updates as quickly as they possibly can to kind of resolve these issues, and that'll help you avoid getting hit as well. Java is a similar situation, right? It's no longer installed on OS X by default. If you don't need it, don't install it. I actually need Java because I use CrashPlan, which relies on Java to run. But the thing is I don't need Java in my browser. So I have disabled it there. And for this latest exploit, it was Java running in the browser that was exploited. So if you're not running Java in Safari, then you're not going to have to worry about getting hit by that that kind of exploit. And once again, keep your Java up to date. When a new release or a new update comes out, go ahead and make sure that you patch it. Acrobat Reader is a similar thing. There have been security holes in Acrobat Reader. I actually don't have Acrobat Reader installed on my system. I just use Preview, and that's maintained by Apple, so I don't have to install Acrobat. That doesn't necessarily mean that that can't get exploited as well, but I'm relying on Apple to make sure they're on top of that and they patch it when something happens. As a matter of fact, Acrobat Reader did just have a security patch released, so if you do use Acrobat Reader, make sure that you go ahead and go in there and update your system. And of course, keep your system up to date. Run your Apple software updates. Make sure you're grabbing the security updates as soon as possible after they come out. And all of these things are going to go to add to those layers of protection that you can help put in place to better keep your system safe. And we just need to stay on top of it. And another layer of this is asking questions and staying informed. So emailing me, asking these types of questions, and having this conversation is a whole nother layer. So security and layers, if you are a MacCast member, you can check that out in the archive. And Rick, thanks for the question. Very timely and makes a lot of sense for us to go over this. I ran across a great piece over on Macworld this week by Rob Griffiths on why you should use fast user switching and multiple user accounts in OS X, even if you are the only one using your Mac. He made several cases, and I will link to the article in the show notes at maccast.com. You definitely should go over there and read it, but I thought we'd just have a little discussion on some of the reasons why you might want to do this. Now, some of you might not even know that it's pretty easy to set up multiple user accounts in Mac OS X. OS X is built on top of Unix. Unix has always been a multi-user operating system, and so consequently, it's very easy to have additional user accounts in OS X. You just go into your system preferences, into the user group preferences, and then you'll need to click the little lock and enter your admin credentials so that you can work within the user and groups system preferences. But once you've done that, you'll see there's a little plus button down in the bottom of the interface where you can add a new account. So adding new accounts is really easy. Multiple accounts are great if you have multiple users on the same Mac. That's the most common reason people use them. But even if you don't use them for that, I'll give you a couple reasons why you might want to use it. And when you have multiple accounts, if you enable fast user switching, that gives you an additional menu item that lets you quickly move between your different accounts. To enable that, in the user group menu, you click on login options, and then you'll see a little checkbox that says show the fast user switching menu option, and that will add an item to your menu bar. You can choose how you want that to look. You can have it be just an icon, a full name, or a short name. That'll show up in the menu bar, and then clicking on that will show you the different accounts that you have enabled, and it'll let you switch between them. And what happens when you switch accounts is that account goes into a suspended mode. The current account that you were just in, it switches over and leaves all of that running in the background, but in the suspended state. So your open apps, your window states, all of that information is maintained, lets you switch over, get into another account, do what you want, and then you can switch back. Each time you switch back and forth, you're going to have to enter the login credentials and information for the account you're trying to access so it stays, you know, secure and everything like that. But as Rob points out, there are some great reasons to run multiple users, even if you're the only one on your Mac. And one is if you want to have a separate admin user account. So when you first set up your Mac, the account that it has you create during the setup process is an admin account. And that account has certain extra privileges over and above what would be called a standard user account. And so for security reasons, getting back to kind of the security conversation we were just having, if you want to have another layer of security, one of those would be not to run an admin account as your day-to-day user account. So set up a separate user account and then leave the admin account in place, use fast user switching, and just switch over to it when you need to do something where you're running as admin. There's very few reasons why most people need to even run as admin. If you need to install something or something that requires admin privileges, you can do that from your regular user account. It'll just prompt you to enter your admin credentials. So you just enter your admin username and password, and it'll let you do that and perform that operation with temporarily heightened privileges under your standard user account. So really very few reasons to run as an admin full-time 24/7. And you can easily, again, set it up with fast user switching and get in there if you have that sort of situation. You can just jump back and forth between the different accounts. So that's a layer of security, one reason why you might want to do it. Another great reason is troubleshooting, having a clean user account that you can jump into. So if your day-to-day user account, you start suddenly getting beach balls, there's weird things going on, maybe you've installed something recently and you're having problems, a good way to test to see if it's isolated to just your user account is to have a plain secondary account, a test user account that you can jump into that's not going to have things like all the menu bar items, background applications, add-ons running, plugins that you might have installed into your main account. You can jump over to it, have a clean environment, do testing in, see if you see the same kinds of behaviors. So if you launch an application and it's crashing under your user account, you could jump into that test user account, launch the same application and see if the same thing happens. If it happens the same way in both accounts, you know there's something going on at a more of a system level or at an application level. If you jump into that test user account and it's not the same thing, you can somewhat assume that it's something isolated to your user account. So it does help with troubleshooting. Another great reason to have multiple user accounts is if you have to give presentations or you need to show stuff on your Mac in public, and you maybe don't want people to see your messy desktop, maybe you don't want to see them to see some of your browser history, maybe you have certain files that are sensitive or confidential, even file names can kind of give a lot of information. Things like your background picture, maybe you have a desktop picture and it's of your family or something that you don't necessarily want to share with someone that you're just giving a business presentation to. So you can create a test account, use fast user switching to jump into it, and you can have just a plain vanilla OS X account that doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles, doesn't have all of your browser history, won't distract your viewers maybe when you're giving a presentation. Maybe you have a cute background of your kids. That could be distracting to someone who, or a pet. That could be distracting to someone who you might be giving a presentation to. So you want them focusing on just the thing you want them to see. And people are just naturally curious. They're going to see file names. They're going to look at your browser history. Hey, where's he been going? What kind of websites does he check out? Take that out of the equation. Set up a separate account that you can use for giving your presentations. Another great one that I had not thought about, I'm not a really big gamer, but Rob mentions that specifically for games, having another user account could be great because it suspends all of the operations and things that are going on within your main account, and switching over to a secondary account is going to give you access to a full 100% of the CPU and the resources that are available to you, or most of that. And it could also be good not just for games, but I would imagine almost any CPU intensive application. So if you need to do a big rendering or something like that, maybe you want to have a separate account that you just use for rendering 3D projects, something like that. There's a lot of applications I think that you could use and use a secondary account for getting that work done. And then a final one is if you use your Mac for both work and personal reasons. And this was another one I hadn't really thought about before, but it's really great. You can have accounts for work and for personal stuff that are separate. And what that means is that you can do things like set up your work email in one account and your personal email in another account and keep that stuff separated. And a reason you might want to do that is to help you avoid distractions of doing personal stuff on work time or doing work stuff on personal time. You add a sort of layer of inconvenience with having multiple accounts and needing to switch back and forth between them. So you're not going to just casually start, browsing your personal email or maybe looking at, your Twitter feed that's in your personal account when you're working on work stuff. You can leave that stuff separated. And if you ever do need to cross the streams and jump across from one to the other during the day, say you're working and you need to jump into your personal account for something, you still can use the fast user switching feature to do that. But that one little extra step is going to avoid that sort of quick temptation to do that. So I thought that was a great article. Bunch of great reasons and information for setting up multiple user accounts, even on a Mac where you're not using multiple users. And if you do have multiple users, multiple people saving, you know, sharing the same Mac, this is also a great way to go to keep all of your stuff separated. I know a lot of people who share a Mac and they just have one user account. You might think about, especially if you have kids or something like that, letting them have their own accounts. And an advantage of having a separate user account is you can also set up restricted user accounts. So you can limit the kinds of permissions, the kinds of things you can layer on parental controls to other accounts that are on a system. And it gives you even more flexibility and functionality to kind of manage that stuff. So lots of good reasons to use multiple user accounts and fast user switching. Received an email from Ernie, who was having a little bit of frustration with doing some importing into iTunes, specifically of some Audible files. What he noticed was that as he was dragging in and bringing in his Audible files into iTunes, they would automatically start playing on import. And he really just wanted to batch add a bunch of audio files and asked, you know, how can I stop iTunes from automatically playing my files when I drag them in? And I had thought that there was a setting for this, but when I was playing around with the latest version of iTunes, I was having, one, a hard time finding the setting, and then two, I was noticing some varying behavior depending upon how I was adding files to my iTunes library. So what I ultimately discovered, Ernie, is that if you drag an audio file and you drop it onto the iTunes icon in the dock, at least for me, what was happening was it would import the song and then it would start to automatically play the song. But I discovered that if I simply opened up iTunes, had the music library window open, and I were to drag the audio file directly into the audio window, that in that case, or into the library window rather, in that case it would import the audio file and it would not start auto-playing. So I think that's going to be your answer, is simply make sure that your iTunes window is open and that you drag it right into the main window, into the main library, and I think it won't auto-play. So don't drop it onto the iTunes icon. But the other thing that I had been thinking about was a setting, and it was related more to importing audio files from CDs. So back in the prior version of iTunes, prior to this latest update, if you went into your iTunes preferences, into the advanced menu, and then clicked on the import settings option, where you could set the bitrate and the information on how you'd want to import audio files from a CD, there was a little checkbox that would say play songs while importing or converting. And if that was checked on, when you would be importing from a CD, it would automatically start to play the audio files that it was importing. And I thought maybe that setting was the thing that you were having trouble with, Ernie. But I don't think that is, I think that only applies to importing songs. Now, interestingly, it looks like that setting has been removed in the latest version of iTunes. So now if you go into iTunes preferences under general, there is the import settings button, and you click that and it brings up a new window, but that checkbox for play songs while importing or converting is not there. If you do want to set that or change that preference, there is a plist terminal command that you can run. So if you open up Applications, Utilities, and Terminal, and then enter a specific command, and I'll have it in the show notes at maccast.com, but it's defaults write com.apple.itunes play songs while importing, and then you set that to false, it will prevent iTunes from auto-playing songs as you import them from, say, a CD. If you need to turn it back on, you run the same command, but set it to true, as the parameter. And again, I'm not giving you the specific commands, so don't try typing those in. Go to the show notes at maccast.com and copy the ones that you find in the show notes to get the exact syntax. But you can do that. An easier way, though, if you prefer a GUI, is to use the secrets system preference pane. I've told you about this on past shows. We've talked about it before. The only thing I don't know is I do not know if it works in Mountain Lion. I know it works up through Lion. You're going to have to check and see if it's Mountain Lion compatible. But if you go to secrets.blacktree.com, this gives you a control panel or a system preference pane that you can go in and you can set all kinds of hidden parameters for different applications. And they do have this one for the latest version of iTunes. So, Ernie, I hope that helps explain what's going on and maybe makes your Audible audio file importing a little more convenient. And then the last thing that I want to talk about today is something that was a personal sort of pet peeve of mine, or something that started to happen recently. I have been getting a more and more crowded menu bar. You know, all that stuff that different applications put there up on the right-hand side of your menu bar? Mine kept growing and growing and growing, and it actually got to be such a problem. I had a total of 19 items up there, and when I would go give a presentation for my user group, it started to encroach on the main application menu items in different apps that I was running. So I was doing a presentation, and when I do that, I connect to a projector, so it actually switches my Mac to a slightly lower resolution than I normally would be running. And in that case, I was losing access to certain menu bar items. They would actually get hidden by the application menus, so I couldn't even access them. Total mess, and I was getting really, really frustrated with it. Finally, it got so bad, I have to do something about this. So I did a little searching around, trying to find a solution, and I ran across a great application called Bartender. I'll give you a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but basically what this does is it gives you a little sub-menu bar that can hang off of your main menu bar, the bartender bar, and you can add or choose to add specific items, either Apple's items or third-party menu bar items to the bartender bar. So you can expand that out and have an even bigger menu bar. Not only that, but you can also completely hide applications from the menu bar, and you can hit hotkeys to extend the menu bar, basically hide the main application menu items temporarily so that you can see more of your menu bar items. And it works great. I absolutely fell in love with it. They have a free trial available on their website, so I started out with the free trial, but within a day or two, I'm like, I have to have this application. I literally just bought it. And you can set up keyboard shortcuts for activating the bartender menu bar. You can choose where items show up. So if items show up in the main menu bar and the bartender menu bar, you can move the positioning of the bartender drop down so you can have it over on the left, over on the right, whichever place makes the most sense or is most convenient for you. And it really is a flexible application, and it's just $15 US. So it was well worth it for me, and it's working very, very well for cleaning up and managing my menu bar items. I now have just a few of the Apple ones up there, and then the little icon for the bartender menu bar. I just click on that, it drops down, and I have access to all the additional items. Things like Text Expander, my Time Machine backups, my ChronoSync, Fantastical, Dropbox, all of those are now in a submenu, cleaned up. And I am a much happier camper when I look at my desktop. And if you want to take things to real extremes, you can have everything totally hidden on the bartender menu bar, so you have nothing in your menu bar items, and you just use a hotkey to actually turn on and make the bartender menu bar visible. So you can have it completely clean, and people will be wondering, where are all your menu bar items? They're completely gone. but your secret will be bartender. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a second and thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can check out all of their software as well as get free trials over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. You can try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MACCAST. Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used iPhones, iPads, MacBooks, and other smartphones. Find out what your gadget is worth today over at gazelle.com. Squarespace, it's a beautiful, intuitive website publishing platform that allows anyone to easily create professional web pages, blogs, online stores, and galleries all on a single platform. You can try it for free, no credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com/maccast to sign up now. Plus, when you purchase a new account, you can get 10% off your order with the offer code MACCAST2. Everything you need to create an exceptional website. ShareFile by Citrix. Take all the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files via old methods like email attachments, FTP with ShareFile. Try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. If you have a question, a comment, something you'd like to hear covered on the show, you can send your email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-M-9, or you can leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MACCAST. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MACCAST, you can go to the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MACCAST Facebook page at facebook.com/themaccast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.